My next guest is Jake Radin, Senior Director of Financial Product and Head of ESG at OpenInvest, who's a really interesting company. So they offer direct indexing to both financial advisors and individual investors. And of course, one of the potential benefits of using direct indexing is that investors can exclude certain stocks based on their own set of values, which that's where the ESG angle comes in. And I should note that prior to OpenInvest, Jake actually led sustainable investing strategy at Pacific Global Asset Management, and he's now on the line with me from Los Angeles. Jake, welcome to the podcast. Great connecting.
Hey, Nate. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here. Can you hear me all right?
I can. Sounds great. So look, I mentioned this at the top, but you and I actually crossed paths on Twitter. So I would say we've had a few friendly debates on both direct indexing and ESG. And so now here we are, right? We're bringing this to life on the podcast. First, I think a good place to start is I've covered this topic multiple times on the podcast before, but we always have new listeners joining. Can you just briefly explain what direct indexing is?
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, direct indexing is the idea that as opposed to buying a fund that tracks some underlying benchmark, that you can just buy all or some of the individual names in that benchmark and hold it in a SMA. That's in essence, you know, the most straightforward way to talk about direct indexing.
And what are some of the benefits of doing that? Why would an investor want to do that?
Yeah, there's a few different reasons, and it depends on the type of the account, the size of the account, and the goals of the investor. But, you know, generally speaking, the most, I think, sort of well accepted, frequent reason quoted for doing direct indexing is tax alpha and assuming you're a taxable account, whereby depending on your optimization and or replication strategy and algorithm, you know, you can take stocks that have gone up and down that lead to the return of the benchmark, and you can advantageously harvest losses and rebuy stocks with similar return profiles or whatever it is you're using to do your security selection and replication. And you can, you know, harvest losses for the year and or excess losses you can carry forward, which allow you to offset gains or income year in and year out on your taxes. And so that's commonly called tax alpha, essentially. So that's kind of the most common reason. I think that's the most universal anyway. There aren't too many people with taxable accounts who wouldn't want to be able to harvest some losses if it doesn't lead to excessive tracking error or otherwise distort the returns of the profile of the portfolio, which is kind of the goal for most direct indexers.
Go ahead.
Oh, and then, you know, the other reasons obviously, or maybe not obvious to some of your new listeners, are around, like you said, values alignment, customization, ESG, some of those considerations. And then there's actually kind of a third category that I think gets talked about a lot less, though you're starting to see it a little bit more in some of the materials from direct indexers and you know, industry pundits and analysts and publications catching on to this, which is reporting, customization, interaction, and engagement with clients. So, I think that's true for both the retail and the advisor-led channel, but the advisor-led channel, I think that's especially important. And we can get into that a little bit. I'm not sure where you have us going, but I'll stop there for a second.
Yeah, no, I actually want to get into each of those points that you made, but I guess just broadly speaking, why is direct indexing becoming more popular now? Because I always hear people say, well, this has been around forever, right? It's basically separately managed accounts. So why is this getting more run now?
Sure. Yeah. Five, six, 7 years ago, running separately managed accounts, you had a lot of considerations that you don't have anymore, or at least they've changed. So, you know, it was very hard. I think the only place doing fractional shares, for instance, 7 or 8 years ago was Folio. At least that was the only one I was familiar with at the time in asset management when we were managing separately managed accounts. And so depending on the size of the account, the size of the rebalance, you could have, you know, much tighter tracking. You could have, you can do more with the cash. You don't have to leave as much left over. You could get closer to your target weights. And so that has become much more ubiquitous, right? Now a lot of brokerages offer fractional shares. So that wasn't true before. And then just overall transaction costs, as we know, have just come down enormously. Commissions on trading have come down quite a bit. So, you know, if you're buying a portfolio of five ETFs and you have to pay a commission, that's five commissions. If you're buying a portfolio of 500 individual names and you had to pay a commission, that's 500 commissions. So the price goes up really quickly when you have to pay for trading. But when you don't have to pay for trading, things get a lot more interesting and your options open up quite a bit. I think people say tech or sort of like sophistication of the tools. That's also incredibly important. And it's a two-sided thing. It's one, the brokerage is opening up APIs and two-way interfaces for folks to build interactions with between their systems and the brokerages to submit trades and rebalance and get account information. It would be really hard to do what we do if that wasn't the case. We'd have to somehow manually load those statements or something like that. And then also, I think the general trend of tech and tech enablement within asset management and just more technology professionals being available to work, you get the ability to build some sort of, you know, hybrid asset management and tech firms such that you have people on staff who are building these interfaces and two-way communication, you know, engineered platforms that allow you to do this. And so it's a confluence of a lot of trends. And, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, yes, you had custom SMAs and you even had people trying to replicate indexes in SMAs, but you didn't necessarily have either the tech enablement or the technical expertise available on both sides to create sort of this ecosystem of tech-enabled trading and rebalancing and account management. And I think that's huge.
So in terms of the benefits of or the potential benefits of direct indexing, you mentioned tax alpha, which we can certainly come back to that. But I want to ask you about this aligning interests with values. I'm sorry, aligning investors' holdings with values. And you've said previously that direct indexing is a huge threat to ESG ETFs in particular, which I actually agree with that. I think that's 100% correct, just because ESG ETFs aren't one size fits all. Right, which I think that's a big problem. However, even more broadly speaking, you've said direct indexing is a threat to all equity index products, which I feel like that's a pretty bold statement. So let's talk more about both of those, why you think direct indexing is a threat to ESG ETFs in particular, but even more broadly to all equity index products.
Sure, yeah. So on the all equity index products, you know, I have a contentious relationship with Twitter, and my earliest attempts at using Twitter, which was being kind of bombastic and loud, probably not the best approach. I've reevaluated some of that, but I stand by things that I've said in spirit, at least. So, you know, I think they're a threat to passive index ETFs. And when I say threat, I don't mean like it's going to zero and direct indexing is going to be 100% of the market. I'm suggesting that like passive index ETFs had no real challenger for the last, I don't know, 5 to 8 years. You know, they had tax advantages and trading advantages for a long time over mutual funds, and they were kind of just running wild. And I think that there are places where direct indexing makes plenty of sense for a number of different types of investors over a passive index ETF. And I think that's where there's a threat, in that the tax alpha component, some of the rebalance timing stuff, arbitrage around publicly disclosed additions and deletions to the index. There's just a lot of things you can do when you're buying the shares instead of buying the ETF shares that I think we're going to see even more kind of sophisticated the changes over time in terms of why there's more value proposition there in owning the shares versus owning the ETF. I think there will always be a place for untaxed accounts potentially to be using passive ETFs. Mm-hmm. There's probably market making and trading reasons why people would still want to use those versus buying all the individual shares at the institutional level. You know, there's probably use cases I'm not even familiar with for why they're not going to die. But I stand by the fact that there's a threat there to everyone just defaulting to passive ETFs all the time, because I think this is a pretty viable alternative for just a number of reasons. On the ESG ETF thing, that's where I think it's an even bigger threat, because there's people mean a lot of different things when they say ESG, and so the fact that even that that's the case makes me question the utility of an ESG ETF, because between ratings dispersion, between changing regulations at a country level, but it's occurring globally, ESG is coming to mean very different things, and ESG ETFs can't change very quickly with those changing definitions. And the world of analyzing so-called non-financial data, aka ESG, that's going to change quickly enough that it's going to be pretty disruptive to the way ESG ETFs are composed and created and eventually die. And more importantly, what you see when you're in the business of direct indexing and helping advisors sell customized solutions to their clients is that the value in ESG isn't necessarily for a lot of people in like best of breed and this is a basket of stocks with the best, like the best opaque broad level ESG scoring. It's far more personal and specific than that. And so, ESG ETFs just can't ever really replicate that. Yes, they can be thematic, they can be narrow, and they can try to appeal to a certain subset or group of people, but that is a market research and marketing and product development nightmare, because it's far easier to make a customized SMA than it is a customized ETF. Where do you stop? Where do you draw the line? How custom do you get on the ETF side to try to capture the varying and frankly changing preferences of people over time? 3-4 years ago, the primary fascination in ESG for most people was around E and environmental situations and environmental considerations. And, post 2020 COVID, George Floyd, the sort of like long ignored S in ESG has finally kind of come to the forefront, and people are actually looking for much more robust and specific and less generic S ESG products. Well, that's really, there are very, very few ESG ETFs that cater to that. And more importantly, the ETF industry was not able to be particularly agile in the face of that changing sort of like global consciousness. Whereas with a direct index SMA, if you have the right ESG research and teams and implementation, given your your optimization, the way you build portfolios, you could potentially respond to that very quickly, or you could have already had the solutions in place ready to go for people. So, it's in a lot of ways, as far as ESG is concerned, it's just a far more agile and customizable way of doing things, and that's important when you're talking about a product or service that is highly personal and highly subjective for folks. And I don't mean to say that there's no such thing as an attempt for people to make ESG objective. And when you're talking about concerns about like financial materiality and more specifically targeting quantifiable metrics like carbon footprinting or water use or something like that. But we could stay on this topic if you want, where it's still better in a SMA to do those things as well.
Well, let me ask you this, and again, I think you and I are on the same page in terms of the threat the direct indexing poses to ESG ETFs in particular. But as you walk through that, which I thought that was an excellent window into how you view direct indexing and ESG, which we can come and talk more about ESG here in a minute. But you mentioned several words. You mentioned responsive, agile, customizable, objective, and I think that gets down the path towards my single biggest concern with direct indexing, and I think this is where you and I have butted heads a little bit on Twitter,
sure.
Which is that direct indexing is basically active management in disguise. And I don't say that as a knock on active, by the way. I think we just know if you look at the data over time, making active decisions in a portfolio tends to detract from returns. And so my concern is by tinkering with index holdings, investor returns will suffer. And the example that I always use, it's the same one, but I'll provide it to you, which is, let's take Facebook. So let's say an investor doesn't want to own Facebook stock because of their data privacy issues. Well, you know, first of all, it is possible that Facebook stock skyrockets, right? And the investor misses out on that because they don't own it. But I think more importantly, what happens if Facebook becomes the gold standard for protecting customer data? What is the decision-making process to add that stock back into the portfolio? It just feels to me like it can be such a slippery slope when investors start picking and choosing which stocks to own based on what I think some would argue are arbitrary reasons. And, you know, investors can now do this with a swipe of a button.
So there's a lot to unpack there. A year's worth of conversations, but let me try to do justice to some of them. So I think maybe this is chronological, or maybe this is just what I think is important. There's a bit of a myth that investors are so obsessed with returns versus everything else that happens in the world when they invest in with regards to companies they may or may not buy the shares of. There are actually a large number of folks who invest who actually are perfectly happy to get market or even slightly below perfect market rate returns in order to have what they care about reflected in their portfolio. And when I say that, I mean a number of different things. I don't just mean screening out Facebook. So the big three levers you have in an SMA where you're implementing, you know, values alignment or ESG are tilting, screening, and engaging, right? And so when you screen, you can't engage. Engage means proxy voting and shareholder resolutions. I mean, it can also just mean reaching out to the company as a shareholder, but generally speaking, taking some sort of action with more teeth in it is involves actually voting the proxies. And then there's tilting, which is saying I am supportive or overweight a thing. And then there's screening, which is, okay, just get me out of this thing. That could also be underweighting. Depends on the direct indexer and the algorithm and the optimization and the approach. But, you know, first of all, you know, what is arbitrary? Is it arbitrary to remove Facebook because of data privacy concerns? I don't actually necessarily think that's arbitrary if that's what you care about. And if the question is, okay, so what's the actual mechanism by which you determine Facebook has either improved or you know further deteriorated its ability to protect your privacy, that doesn't have to be an arbitrary decision. Like, so, you know, we have thousands and thousands of accounts across retail and advisors at OpenInvest, I think, although maybe I shouldn't quote that because I don't have the exact number. But the point is we have more accounts than one person could sit there and personally make individual portfolio decisions on. And so, you know, we have developed data sets and data collection and processes and procedures for evaluating each indicator that informs an ESG thing. And so, you know, one way to avoid, I think, what you're expressing as a concern of sort of like renegade active management decisions around ESG stuff is to have a very clear and transparent and accountable process by which you make those decisions, which is what drives everything we do at OpenInvest. And so I think that's an important consideration. And I'm not suggesting other people don't do that as well. But I think you can use the big third-party data providers, or you can go out and find your own data, or you can use some hybrid model of the two. The important thing is that you are consistent, that you are clear with your clients and advisors and partners what you're doing, and that you apply that universally and consistently for folks. And so I think you can kind of erase the idea that it's arbitrary. I think you can always have a healthy debate about, okay, well, what is your indicator for Facebook data privacy? And there are a number of ways to try to attack that problem, but that's more of an ESG methodological issue, I believe, than it is like a renegade active management problem, potentially.
Jake, just a couple of minutes left here. Let me lob you another question that probably has an hour-long answer, which we're not going to have time for. We'll have to do this again. But With ESG, I mean, what do you specifically think the impact of ESG investing is? Like, do you think it impacts a company's cost of capital? Do you think it catalyzes change at companies? You know, I think of what we just saw with Exxon and Engine Number One recently. What do you view? I mean, just to the average investor, what do you view as the purpose or the longer term impact of ESG investing?
I think first and foremost, people need to do what they feel is right. And if you're talking about hard-earned money or long-term saved money, it's really important to offer people the opportunity to have some agency over that. The idea that you would sort of divorce people's values and agency over what they do with their money when people's investments and savings tend to be, you know, either a large piece or even a majority of their assets. To me, that has always been kind of an insane situation. Like, we make personal decisions based on our values all day long, every day, with every single thing that we do. The idea that somehow you could magically, or that it would be a good idea to divorce people from doing that with their savings too, to me seems like a concept I've never personally understood. Whether I speed on the street outside of my house or not is a values-based decision that I make every day. Like, I'm charged with lots of decisions in my life all the time that I have to make quick and maybe even more considered value judgments about how I behave or act. And so, I think the world is awakening to the fact a little bit more, especially in the asset management financial industry, financial services industry, that, like, actually that isn't some kind of unbreakable covenant that somebody before us agreed to, that of course we can have agency over those things. And so, I think that's an important thing, to give people a tool to be involved with. And in terms of the long-term impact, I mean, it could save Exxon from climate change. That's a pretty good impact, right? It absolutely changes the way companies behave and the way they message. And I would actually argue that it's ESG in the last 10 years has provided a really important kind of live experiment for government regulators to pay attention to and finally take a stand on and start to change the way they regulate. Because it was largely at the discretion of clients and investment managers previously, but now you're finally starting to see, even in one of the last stalwart holdouts in the U.S., you've started to see the Fed and the SEC do their requests for comments, and the countdown has started for climate change and probably some other social and environmental issue regulations to come. And so there's absolutely a theory of change there, that just by being loud about what matters to you and what you care about, and if you have some money to put behind that, that people, it does cause change. Whether it's the cost of capital for some folks, yeah, that's going to happen. That's going to happen for the worse actors. We already see it reducing the cost of capital. Green bonds have incredibly low rates, right? And so do some other more exotic types of, like, sustainability linked bonds, water bonds, that kind of thing. So, like, it's not universal necessarily. It may not be an incredibly easy relationship to tease out in every single instance, especially when you're talking about equity as opposed to debt. But there's no question in my mind that there are knock-on financial effects to various types of ESG considerations and investing. And then there's, of course, the whole sort of shift we're seeing with, as you mentioned, Engine Number One and Exxon and board seats, where you're finally starting to see some of these shareholder resolutions around climate change and other sort of ESG topical issues, like, finally getting institutional shareholder support. And that has always been kind of the holy grail there, because you've had small shareholders and groups of shareholders trying to get these things, and even actually getting resolutions passed, but, you know, they would be ignored. They were non-binding. And so, you know, Exxon would ignore calls for people to look at their or to issue climate change reports or inventory their stranded assets or whatever the case may be. And so the getting everybody aligned is going to force major change. And like I said, it may actually save Exxon from itself in the face of, like, absolute recalcitrance in the face of a changing world and a dying business model. And so I don't know how else to convince someone that this stuff leads to change, but there it is.
Well, Jake, I thought that was really well articulated. I truly appreciate your perspective on both direct indexing and ESG. I certainly look forward to some future Twitter interactions with you. Thank you for joining me this week. Appreciate it.
Yeah, of course, Nate. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it. Take care.
That was Jake Radin, Senior Director of Financial Product and Head of ESG at OpenInvest.